Hi. This, I know I called The Guardian today by the Director of Liberty, Martha Spurrier, a barrister, human rights lawyer. And it's in response to a Dominic Raab move, part of a broader move by the government involving people like Priti Patel as well. But there's been a move in the government to try and it's been promised since 2010 and before. The Tory party is full of members who are extremely angry about what's been going on in the UK over the last 20 odd years. Many people see an empowerment of the courts and a frustration of process, and obviously the most salient manifestation of this has been the complete inability of the government to stop the constant flow of small boats across the channel from France into the UK, and Priti Patel has been given the probably hopeless task of trying to find a legal solution. I think the last time I looked, they were suggesting camps in Albania. They were in negotiations with the Albanian government to use Albania as a kind of British Tasmania. I think is it Tasmania or is it one of the other islands? But the Australians processed their asylum claims offshore, and that did a lot to reduce the total number. So Dominic Raab has been criticising The Guardian by Spurrier on the basis that his proposals to change the way that the so-called human rights laws operate in the UK would involve putting the government above the law and lead to the abuse and the denial of human rights for ordinary people. So the suggestion is that Raab, who is a lawyer himself, I think if I'm right, I think I'm right in saying that he worked for Linklaters, which is a big London firm. But I think Raab is a law graduate and a trainee solicitor at one point. And the suggestion by Spurrier is that he's looking to reduce protections and disempower the judges. And as I say, this part of a broader movement in government to try and do something to address the balance between the courts and the government. The government was mightily provoked by the Supreme Court's findings, both in the Gina Miller Brexit case and also in other cases, like for example the prorogation of Parliament, and in the denial of Shamima Begum the right to come back to the UK to pursue her case against the government for the stripping her of her citizenship. It looks as if the Supreme Court has recognised that it's been provocative towards the government, and they've kind of, a Tory would say, they've wound their neck in a little bit. The Adam Tomkins, the constitutional law professor at Glasgow Uni, suggested that the terms in which they couched the Supreme Court couched the judgment in the Scottish Government's recent cases indicates that they're actually taking a kind of Parliament as sovereign and the UK as a unitary state view, rather than giving the SNP any running room at all, and therefore any future argument about the right of the SNP to hold a referendum based on something about majorities in the Scottish Parliament or whatever they choose to try and nail it on, that'll fail as well, because the court is moving back from the Lady Hale interventionist approach to something much more like what the Americans would call strict constructionism. So Spurrier thinks this is just an attempt to insulate the state from any sanction and control and oversight, because it's the courts that provide oversight. So this supposed overhauling of the Human Rights Act and its replacement with a British Bill of Rights. Now, the Bill of Rights is, of course, Parliament against the Crown. The British, the expression "the Bill of Rights" is 1688 and all that. You know, it's the Glorious Revolution and the finally the introduction of William and Mary as in the so-called joint monarchy and the final establishment of Parliament being sovereign over the Crown after the 17th century battle between the two, and the continued obfuscation and the use of the expression the King in Parliament or the Queen in Parliament as being the sovereign, neatly aligning over the question as to who is sovereign. And of course, the reality is that this is a crowned republic; the Parliament is sovereign. So the Bill of Rights is Parliament's sovereignty over any other body in the land. As the great Thomas Hobbes says, "'Tis not the unity of the represented, it is the unity of the representor that maketh the people one." In other words, there's no such thing as the British people until there's a British Parliament. And then there's a British Parliament because the British Parliament holds absolute sovereignty over the British people, who are all united in the command of that Parliament, when it says jump, we all say how high. And that way, we become impossible to resist. There can be no, as Hobbes would say, intestine or foreign power that can dare challenge us. Because if we all obey one word of command, then like a Spartan phalanx, we can become extremely powerful. So the Bill of Rights that people know about and a so-called British Bill of Rights are two radically different things. Because when Rabb and the Tories are talking about a British Bill of Rights, they're rhetorically appealing to something that Tories like, which is the 17th century triumph of Parliament over the Crown, and therefore the sort of this Whig view of history that we've moved inexorably towards liberty under the law, and that Roundheads are boring but right. So common sense in a British Bill of Rights is designed by Rabb and other Tories to appeal to something deep in the British psyche and to appeal to something that we value. But he's talking about something radically different, which is, to put it bluntly, to try to put a fig leaf on what is genuinely an attempt to reduce the importance of the Human Rights Act without exciting more opposition than is absolutely necessary. Now, Spurrier, being the director of Liberty and a barrister and a human rights lawyer, is in early in her characterisation of what the government's about. So what she thinks the government is actually talking about is reduced rights and justice for the well-behaved and no state accountability. So a state, and the state is not quite the same thing as the government, but a state that can act without sanction, without it won't be found against in the courts. And for example, one of the examples she uses repeatedly is the attempt to recast the right to a family life, such as to prevent it being used to frustrate the deportation of foreign criminals. Because at the minute, what happens is the amount of time it takes to get somebody out of the UK, they've probably had kids or something similar, at least got into a relationship with somebody else. Famously, the example of somebody having a cat, it was cited by the lawyer during the pleadings. It wasn't key, but nevertheless, it was cited during the pleadings as part of the evidence that they'd assumed family responsibilities. And therefore, this right to a family life has been used to frustrate the deportation of foreign criminals. There's also a move towards a more general power to revoke citizenship. Begum, as I mentioned earlier, had her citizenship revoked because the government judged that I think she had the right to apply for Bangladeshi citizenship from memory, but she had the right to apply for a foreign citizenship. And despite the fact that she never had applied, and that the other country certainly, might have been Pakistan, but I think it was Bangladesh, had said that they'd no intention of granting it her and would deny it if she applied. But despite all that, they revoked her citizenship, and they seem to have been successful in doing it. And that's to become more general. So what you're going to end up with is a situation, as Spurrier says, where your protection against this kind of move by the government is going to vary by your immigration status. So someone like me, who was born in Dumfries in Scotland, is going to have a different status to someone who acquired citizenship because they came from Sudan or Syria or somewhere else, or alternatively, their parents came from Pakistan or India. So you're creating a tiered kind of citizenship. Now, Spurrier makes the old claim, which is the denial of rights anywhere is the denial of rights everywhere, because rights are indivisible. If they're human rights, then they apply to all humans everywhere. And I'll suggest later on that while that's true, what we're actually talking about in these cases isn't human rights I'll mention it now, for the obvious reason that they're not rights available to humans everywhere, and there's been no attempt made to provide them for humans everywhere. In other words, when you cash out what Spurrier thinks are human rights, what she actually means to say is that these human rights, in her understanding, played out in this society with these other provisions that are made by government constitute the rights themselves. They don't. It's a bit like saying, for example, that I've got a perfect right to pursue happiness, therefore I've got a perfect right to access the Swedish welfare state and education system. Very obviously don't. A right to pursue happiness as a general right possessed by humans everywhere isn't a right to the specific realisation of what that right would mean were I genuinely entitled to access the Swedish welfare state and education system. These are two different things. So Spurrier's argument, it seems to me, is false and self-evidently so, but I'll talk about that a wee bit more later if I can. So The attempt to recast these core Human Rights Act, Convention of Human Rights provisions in terms of a family right, a right to a family life and the right to privacy, the attempt to recast them so as to prevent the further use in cases like, for example, in Spurrier mentions LGBTQI cases or eviction cases, or privacy cases, data harvesting cases, and so on. The attempt by RAB and the government to restrict the use of these, as it were, WD-40 rights within the convention. The Human Rights Act contains things like the right to a fair hearing in the determination of your civil liberties and criminal cases, Article 6. And that, for criminal defence lawyers, is a really key article. The article on a right to a family life for people who are involved in deportation cases is core. It's like duct tape. It can be used for almost every purpose. Now, as well as these rights, which are used as devices to frustrate the government in its designs, public agencies like the prison service and the Home Office, as well as these, there's also an obligation in public bodies to actively promote rights. I think that Hamza Yousaf, the Scottish Health Minister, or more accurately his wife, I think, who actually took the case, but I think she won her complaint to the Health and Care Commission, I think it was, because the body, the nursery, actually had, now it's not a public body, I don't think, but it actually had some legal obligation to actively promote equality. And I think they didn't have any procedures in place. So I don't think Yousaf's wife won on the basis that their kid had been discriminated against or they had. It was rather that the nursery couldn't demonstrate that it had the procedures in place to actively promote equality and diversity. And that was why they lost. And there's a similar obligation in public bodies. So it's not just that public bodies can't act wrongly in terms of denying you a right to a fair hearing, is that they've got a positive obligation to promote certain things and therefore have to, as it were, go out of their way to promote certain things, the quality of access and so on. So there's an attempt by the government again to reduce that positive obligation. And the suggestion is that this will, again, deprive those who are looking for justice of a tool that's been very useful in the past. So the terrible army camp deep cut, I'll always remember, it was burned into my neural circuits. One of the remarks in the report on deep cut said that the camp could be a pretty intimidating place at night after dark. The camp could be a pretty intimidating place with gangs of drunken soldiers roaming the camp. Now, there was a lot of suicides and there was a suspicion of some murders in deep cut. And it went on for many years. And the attempt by the lawyers to, you know, hold the Minister of Defence to account would have been difficult or impossible, perhaps, had it not been the case that they could make use of the positive obligation to ensure the safety and welfare and the rights of the folk in the camp. So if you take away the positive obligation or you reduce the positive obligation, you make it more difficult for the lawyers looking to hold bodies like, for example, the Minister of Defence to account. You make it more difficult for folk to pursue a case. And the same holds true of, for example, the rapist war boys. The taxi driver who was drugging women and then assaulting them, he, both in the Met's investigation of the offences that were being reported to it and the attempt by his lawyers to get him out because he'd been well behaved and had taken part in various rehabilitation programmes in prison. In both cases, the Met was held to account, I think, and the Home Office, I think, decided to reverse the parole board's decision. Don't quote me on that, but from memory, I think they did the unusual thing and reversed the parole board's recommendation, and he wasn't released because of arguments made based on this positive obligation to ensure other people's rights, and it would be harder to prosecute arguments like that where you're not able to rely on the positive obligation of public bodies. The same holds true, as I've said earlier, about the Hillsborough inquest. The obligation of Yorkshire Police, South Yorkshire Police, I think it was at the time, But the obligation of the police to actually secure the rights of the folk attending the football game becomes an argument for the lawyers looking to hold them to account. And if you remove these obligations, you make it more likely that the public bodies can behave either with impunity or certainly with a reduced concern for the future consequences for themselves if they've acted badly. So the state becomes much less accountable and much less likely to be held responsible for acts of its agents. And this is a problem because the state's agents are the ones who are particularly able and positioned to engage in the violation of rights. So it's the police, for example, that have got the right to put you in a cell and therefore can beat you up or otherwise mistreat you. It's the army that are on the streets sometimes, especially in Northern Ireland, obviously, with high-velocity rifles. So it's not just anybody who's likely been in a position to fire large numbers of rifle rounds at a crowd. It'll be the military. So if you reduce the obligation of state bodies to maintain rights, you make it much less likely that the people who are most likely to be in a position to engage in particularly serious or egregious infringements of rights, you make it less likely that they'll be able to be held to account. Most folk, I think, are aware of the case of Kathleen Stock. Was it Stock or Stock? Kathleen Stock, I'm sure. But the academic, I think, Surrey, who resigned, having been widely criticised for her supposedly transphobic comments. Philosophy lecturer, I think. But she's now gone. And I think she instantly got a post with somebody else based on her her strong stand. But Rab suggests that this culture of the infringement of free speech requires new protection. This is characterised by the Director of Liberty as being precisely the opposite, that what Rab's looking to do is protect speech for those who say things that the government finds attractive. And what we're actually looking at is a denial of free speech, because free speech is specifically protected in the Human Rights Act. So what the government's real design is to reduce free speech and protest for those that it finds disagreeable and problematic. Most obviously, the climate change activists and the Extinction Rebellion law have been causing such a lot of trouble in London. So the measures that have been introduced at the moment are going to make it much more difficult to engage in those kinds of actions. And the Director of Liberty thinks that this is an infringement of liberty. And the Extinction Rebellion protests resulted in huge public anger. And the suspicion has to be that a government kind of on the ropes over a lot of things, including COVID, is looking for opportunities to do things that are going to get the Daily Mail readers back on side. And there is no more obvious target than the Extinction Rebellion and other climate change protesters. The measures that have been introduced are also proposing the removal of the whistleblower defence for Official Secrets Act cases. Most people who have had anything to do with the state have signed the Official Secrets Act at some point. I think I've signed it a couple of times. And they keep the piece of paper. They file it away. The British state is very good at keeping pieces of paper, which is why, of course, Ho-Ho got hung. Joyce got hung at the end of the war because he'd applied wrongly for a passport as an Irish citizen and attempted to take the King's protection and therefore got himself hung for it because the British state kept a piece of paper. I've probably said it before, but I like quoting it. A.G.P. Taylor, the historian, said that he was the first man ever to be hung for making a wrongful application for a passport, the usual punishment being a 5-shilling fine. But so the government is looking to change the law on in all these areas and remove the right of judges to declare that parliamentary laws, government provisions, are incompatible with the Human Rights Act. I was in the Court of Session one day and I watched a Court of Session judge put a defence lawyer, put the plaintiff's lawyer on the back foot by asking whether he was characterising the actions he was complaining about as being incompatible with the Human Rights Act. Because, of course, flat incompatibility is something the court can't do anything about. All they can do is declare it to be incompatible. And the lawyer knew exactly where the judge was going with this and said, oh, no, I'm saying it's entirely compatible that these provisions mean that they should have done what I suggest they should have done. They should have had a Zoom call rather than simply a voice call, because the provisions in the Mental Health Act don't stipulate that it can't be a Zoom call, and therefore it should be, given this was available. But as I say, the courts can declare that provisions are incompatible with the Human Rights Act, and the government's proposal is to reduce that or remove it, and to stop judges ordering remedies against public bodies that are hugely onerous. I don't know, I haven't checked, but I'll speculate that what they'll actually do is they'll say remedies hugely onerous against the actual benefit to the individual concerned. So if somebody is complaining about the actions of a bureaucracy, then the remedy ordered by the court can't be such as to impose a ridiculous obligation on the public body to remedy this issue if the costs are out of all proportion to the benefits. It's the principle from the Freedom of Information laws. They can deny you an FOI request if the cost is hugely disproportionate. So if you're asking for data, which would be enormously expensive to collect, then they could deny that. There's also the proposal to adjust remedies based on your past conduct. And this is obviously aimed at people who are claiming asylum or are prisoners in jail. So if, for the sake of argument, you're arguing that something was done that infringed your rights and you have a long record of behaving badly and frustrating process and infringing other people's rights, then there's a sort of clean hands element to your pitch. So you can't, a bit like, for example, seriously assaulting the police and then it's found as a matter of fact that one of the cops used excessive force in your subsequent detention when you were being subdued. While it might be true that this was unlawful, it's in the context of the massive force that you used earlier that provoked the entire situation. So the courts are going to be in a position to consider your conduct when they consider the remedy. So the bad behaviour of somebody claiming asylum, the lawlessness, the attempt, for example, if they were suspected of terrorist activity, to frustrate observation by MI5 and the security and the anti-terrorist police, that might be relevant. There's also going to be a requirement for people pursuing these quintessential rights cases to demonstrate significant disadvantage at an early stage before they can proceed. So they're going to have to show that there's been some significant wrong that they've suffered thanks to this averred denial of rights before the case can proceed, and the lawyers can use court process to recover documents and to ask the other side for witness statements and the like. Now, of course, being a lawyer, Spurrier says, well, this is a huge problem because the evidence is in the hand of the people you accuse. So until you actually get the process underway and start demanding documents and CCTV video and so on, then you won't actually be able to demonstrate the strength of your case. So if there's a prior obligation to demonstrate that you've suffered significant harm, and you can't actually proceed to the discovery stage of a hearing before you've done that, then you won't be able to get past first base, because you won't be able to use the discovery process to establish to the court's satisfaction that you really have suffered the disadvantage that you say you've suffered. Now, what the government isn't doing is withdrawing from the Convention of Human Rights, the Council of Europe. So Spurrier says if they go ahead and do what they're suggesting, all that will happen is there'll be a collision course with Strasbourg. So all these cases that would otherwise have been dealt with at an earlier stage, because the government and the courts would have recognised the provisions of the Act, what will now happen is that you'll end up in Strasbourg instead. So nothing will actually have changed. If they continue with the reforms but don't withdraw from the Council of Europe, then all they're doing is storing up a wall of trouble in terms of appeals all the way through to the Strasbourg court. The provision that Spurrier mentions last is voter ID for elections, and suggests that this is again part of this broader government agenda to try to canalise and disempower the opposition. So what we're looking at is a broad process of guaranteeing, as she says, government victories. The government has to win, and has to not only win elections, but has to to win court cases, or even better, not have court cases at all. So this is a question, she thinks, of government against the people, and the government's looking to make itself immune from criticism. It's an argument that very obviously is not going to just appeal to the left, but following the defeat of the government last night, the loss of control of the government last night of, I think, 99 or 100 MPs, and the concession, I think, this morning that the government will appear before Parliament before any other measures. They're not going to try and use existing executive powers to do anything else. They'll come before Parliament and get approval in the future, given the scale of last night's rebellion. So the, I think 99 or 100 Tory MPs rebelled last night. So the article by Spurrier is one that would normally appeal to the kind of radical Guardian left. But given the COVID restrictions, it's an argument that might appeal to more and more on the libertarian Tory right as well. It's the sort of thing that a person like David Davis, the former Tory leadership candidate and the Brexit negotiator, who I think resigned as an MP and triggered a by-election on civil liberties grounds, is the sort of thing that that he would be probably, I think, sympathetic to. I just had a thought that made me laugh. I used to make a joke that I'd been thrown out of the Tory party for extremism, and that used to get a laugh out of students. And of course, after my comments about Marcus Rashford and immigration and food banks and various other things, you could argue that I was thrown out of the Tory party for extremism. I wasn't actually. I was suspended. If I'd sat through the process, then I would have been exonerated, because the Daily Record's characterisation of what I actually said is just, inept. But anyway, what I'm going to say about rights is probably going to get me exactly the same kind of response, and it'll be exactly the same hostage to fortune in the future. This whole discourse on rights sounds sensible. It's very, very hard to be against rights in the same way that it's hard to be against motherhood and apple pie. How can you possibly be against rights? It doesn't make any sense. And the trouble is that 2,500 years ago, political philosophers pointed out exactly why democratic politics would go wrong because of this kind of thing, because of the advantage that is held by the sausage seller over the serious person who's trying to make a developed case. I was effing and blinding yesterday on a WhatsApp message to a former student and a pal who might be listening to this. Hi, Ewan. But I was effing and blinding about the business on Twitter of constantly being faced with people who say things that are just ridiculously provocative because they refuse to think. So they continually say that the parties have to work together to defeat the SNP. And no matter how many times you explain exactly how that goal could be advanced by changing the electoral system, they won't listen. And when it comes to rights, there's nothing you can do. Everyone is automatically in favour of rights. And it's precisely the situation that Orwell described about language. If you can bend the language out of shape and make tyranny safety, so we have to secure safety, by which we mean locking people up arbitrarily and beating them with rubber hoses. As long as you can make locking people up arbitrarily and beating them with rubber hoses an exercise in safety rather than tyranny, then people will support it, because who could be against safety? So the idea that you can be against rights is very problematic. But in actual fact, if you stop and think for 2 seconds, it's very easy to be against rights. Because the whole idea of rights is that you don't have any and the government grants them. Now, the Americans, in their Bill of Rights, correctly note that the existence of these rights doesn't preclude the existence of others. And the reason why they did that was because they knew that as soon as you write down what someone's supposed rights are, people tend to say, well, there you go, that's an extensive list. That's the list of all the rights. One of the things that employment lawyers tell employers is be very careful when you specify in great detail what the employee has to do, because the courts will probably take the view, or the tribunals will take the view, that that's the list of things that they have to do. Whereas if you simply require, if you require someone to be a professional educator, then almost anything could be implied in that agreement to be a professional educator. If you lay down that they have to hand out 3 pieces of homework every week and do 2 hours of preparation and you know, sweep the office once every 14 days, then the court will pretty much take the view that that's what they have to do and nothing else. So statements of rights are dodgy things because they're usually taken to be exhaustive. They're taken to be, this is what your rights are. And they tend to be predicated in this kind of European idea that the state is first and the citizens are after. And therefore, you've got a perfect right to do what the state tells you a right to do and nothing else. Now, in the UK, you've got absolute liberty to do anything and then the state prohibits. So the presumption is in favour of the citizen. You can do exactly as you please. So you don't have, it's not a question if you have rights, it's that you're faced with obligations. And the obligation you face is that you mustn't break the criminal law. But if the criminal law doesn't prohibit it, then you've got a perfect right to do it. So this idea of rights is problematic right from the outset, because it implies that the state has a right to do things that are really appalling, but that you can be resist them because you can have the courts, you can pray and aid the courts. And when I read the piece by Spurrier, I remembered the old, I think, 1772 case, the slavery case, Somerset versus Stuart. The court held that slavery was such an odious condition that it was impossible for anyone to be a slave in the UK unless or in Great Britain, unless the sovereign parliament, the mighty Leviathan that we'd all handed over our right to decide to, unless the parliament had actually allowed for the condition of slavery, then it was impossible for anyone to be a slave because the presumption was in favour of freedom. And therefore, you didn't need a right to not be a slave. That right was so self-evident. It was only an obligation or a power on the part of the parliament that could require a person to remain in a state of slavery or allow another to put them into it. So the whole discourse on rights is, I think, wrong-headed from the outset. There's a presumption in favour of freedom, and then it requires enormous efforts by government, including putting legislation through both houses of parliament, and the presumption being against the government, so they have to be specific. The famous line in tax law is that, you know, you're entitled to arrange your affairs so as to minimise your tax liability, and the government has to be highly specific because the money's yours. So if they make a mistake in drafting, the presumption's in favour of the taxpayer, not the government. So the whole way of looking at our condition under government by people like Spurrier is just wrong from the outset, I think. If we stop and think of what a right is, it's really a power on the part of whoever gets to decide what the right is. And of course, the most obvious example of that is the US Supreme Court and its relationship to the Constitution, and in particular the Bill of Rights. There was an article in the Glasgow Herald a couple of weeks ago by the law professor Adam Tomkins, and Tomkins was talking about the Roe versus Wade case, which is being challenged in the Supreme Court right now. And Tomkins made exactly the kind of distinction that will never be accepted as being valid by most of the people who would consider this issue. He made a distinction between the substantive issue of abortion and the issue of which court has competence and whether the Roe judgment was defensible in law. And he argued that regardless of your view of abortion, Roe was badly decided. And it was badly decided because it was tendentious. The judges had decided from the outset they were going to find the case in one way and oblige the states to not prohibit abortion. And once they'd made that decision, they then confected arguments about the rights of individuals to privacy, which were just nonsense. There was no such right to privacy, and if there had been, it wouldn't have implied an abortion. If you imagine a very large, I mean, the philosophical examples are often objectionable, but if you imagine a very large person opening up their bodily cavity and having a one-year-old child placed inside it, you couldn't then thereby murder the child. because they were within a bodily cavity and there was a right to privacy. There's no constitutional right to carry out what would otherwise be a criminal act if the act takes place within a bodily cavity, and that would include a uterus. So there's no right to privacy, and if there were a right to privacy, it wouldn't imply in and of itself a right to an abortion. Maybe people do have a right to an abortion, but that's a completely separate issue as to whether the United States Supreme Court is allowed to require of the states which are constitutionally privileged and come before the federal government, whether the federal government has got a right to require of the states that they not prohibit abortion is a completely different thing. So Tompkins, as I say, wrote quite a crisp little piece in the Herald about how Roe was badly decided. And Roe is just the most obvious example of a general problem in our modern society in the West, when we've come to rely on courts to address issues that should have been addressed democratically. And however benign a despotism is, a benign despotism is still a despotism. So in a democracy, if the citizenry can't shake themselves and consider problematic issues like, for example, abortion, and therefore there's a habit put in place where people look to the courts to secure for themselves things that should have been secured through a democratic process. For example, you know, if you in a modern liberal democratic society, if you think people have got a right to the provision of certain or people should have a procedural right to the provision of certain state services like health or whatever, then you have to form a political party or lobby an existing party or lobby existing MPs and say that while health services don't fall like manna from heaven, in this society at this stage of our development, we should provide free health cover. If you imagine, for example, in the United States, that Obama in 2008-2016, in that period, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, was implemented, and then there was various court challenges. If you imagine that someone could have claimed that they had a positive right to life, and that therefore the United States had failed in its obligations because it hadn't provided a single-payer UK-style National Health Service. In just those circumstances, most folk would have thought that argument was so tendentious it was ridiculous, that it was an attempt to subvert the democratic process by making an argument which, while it might appeal in terms of its objective to the group of people who constitute the justices of the Supreme Court, not even they could bring themselves to accept such a ludicrous argument, because it's for people to elect a Democrat like Obama and a Congress and to spell out in the Affordable Care Act exactly what you are and aren't entitled to. But there's been a tendency in the West to try to, as much as possible, get round the laziness and the lack of concern that people have for politics and the weaknesses in the political systems, like, for example, in the US, which prevent, you know, almost anything happening because of the fractured nature of the institutions, or in the UK, the doctrine of the mandate and the slavish adherence to candidates, to the party whip. These systematic problems in political systems need to be addressed by an act of citizenry. And we can't really tolerate an expansion of this mistake where you look to benign despots who happen to be judges at a moment in time and say, wouldn't it be nice if I had this and others had it too? Why don't you judge the case in this direction so that that'll happen? There's much that needs to be done to make the good society, but that doesn't imply that every single procedural right, every single right that you have because you're French or because you're Spanish, it doesn't imply that every single right you have by dint of your citizenship in some democracy is a universal human right that can be forced on other citizens. The cost of it can be forced on other citizens, and the fact of it can be forced on everyone. Because you've taken a case to court and a judge agreed with you, because the judge essentially thought that the political system was incapable of providing what it could provide if people made more effort, and therefore they'll get round the weaknesses of the system and the laziness of the people by doing what a good man would do were he an autocrat, were he Lee Kuan Yew. Well, you know, the goodness of the action doesn't tell us about its legitimacy. Or people could run into banks with shotguns and use the proceeds to give money to the starving poor in the third world. And it's for judges who actually disregard motives and intentions all day, every day, when they jail people for theft and robbery and assault. The man who assaults the man who hit his wife acted from a noble motive and maybe even with a reasonable intention, because it might be the case the community in which he lives, only a violent assault on such a person will actually stop it happening again, given that witnesses won't come forward and the police take little care. Well, in just those circumstances, that man had a good motive and a good intention, but the courts will jail him just the same. So how the judges themselves can imagine that their motives and intentions can possibly be a defence for this kind of benign autocracy is beyond me, because they wouldn't accept it from anybody else. So if there's been a failure, as I would argue there has been in Scotland over the management of the COVID crisis, and back in March, April, the government put people who were unvaccinated and not known to be uninfected, or in some cases actually known to be infected, they took these people out of hospitals and put them in care homes where the care of both them and others would be less than it would have been in the hospital. And as a consequence, Scotland had a ridiculously high percentage of its total COVID deaths in care homes. Now, is it a good thing, looking into an indefinite future, that we have slavish party voting in Scotland? We have a parliament where lots of MSPs are so devoted to the party, they won't actually hold the government to account. So we've got SNP MSPs who voted in by people who take no real concern as to who is put forward by the party or what they might have done. And they then go to the parliament and take no concern as to what Jean Freeman and Nicola Sturgeon might have done. And then the solution to this kind of maladministration and bad government is for someone to claim that their elderly relative had a right to life and that they had a right to a family life with this elderly relative. And therefore the decision to empty the hospitals and fill the care homes was inconsistent with their right to life and a family life. Is that a way of actually running a society? So you have unaccountable government that will never be rendered democratically accountable, and individuals then granting to unelected judges the right to decide on executive competence, which would more appropriately be decided by a revolution, a revolt in the parliament, and the downfall of the government and the sacking of ministers and the reformation of a government. Because the fundamental accountability of a government in the UK is through the parliament. And for us to actually tolerate a neutered parliament, to manufacture a neutered parliament, I mean, Westminster is bad, but Holyrood is 1,000 times worse. So right now, for example, as I say, last night we had 99 Tory MPs who actually showed a bit of courage and a bit of principle and actually said thus far and no further. There has never, just in my memory, thinking about it, there has never been anything similar in the Scottish Parliament. And as I say, I think however much you like the outcome of a bad process, you have to ask yourself whether you really are prepared to tolerate the principle that underpins that bad process. And it's a bad process to have governments held to account because of opaque, sweeping statements of rights, and then plaintiffs who've been ill-treated. You're effectively creating a shadow democratic process, or actually a shadow anti-democratic process, where a government makes use of a parliamentary majority to become completely unaccountable to the parliament, because the parliamentary majority is composed of people who wear a label that essentially says, I'll never defy the government's whip. And then you put the citizens in a position where, having not made proper use of their vote, they try to make improper use of the courts. And I don't think that's an acceptable system looking into an indefinite future, because it's animated by a bad principle in exactly the same way that running into the Bone Society with a shotgun full of rice in order to get money for the poor is animated by a bad principle. Now, when it comes to the deportation of people who don't have a right to be in the UK, and the frustration of that deportation because of their supposed right to a family life, this is not just nonsense, but nonsense on stilts. It would be an infringement of a general right to live a life and to be free from state interference if it wasn't warranted, aka a right to a family life. It would be an interference in someone's right to such a life if, having deported them to Sierra Leone, you then prevented someone that they wish to have a relationship with joining them in Sierra Leone. That would be a frustration of the right to a family life. But a right to a family life which you conceive of as a human right isn't a right to a family life in the UK. That's nonsense on stilts. And it can be seen to be nonsense on stilts when we look at the actual lack of concern for people bringing foreign wives to the UK. If you are married to a Filipino or a Thai or whatever, somebody from a poorer country, you have to demonstrate you've got a minimum income. My friend recently married somebody from another country, a national from another country, and he had to demonstrate he had resources such that she wouldn't be a charge in the British state. And he had to show he'd quite a lot of money, and he was allowed to take account of the fact that he owned his own home and so on. So we accept that because we accept that the whole world doesn't have a right to reside in the UK, and that not every British citizen has a right to grant to somebody else an absolute right to reside in the UK. The British state would perhaps act wrongly if it prevented me travelling to the Gambia to marry somebody. That might be an infringement of my general right to live my life as a carer. But it's not an obligation of the British state to grant to me the absolute right to import anybody from anywhere around the world and grant them not only the general right to go about their business, aka have a family life, but to have a family life here in the UK with me. And what's curious is that we accept that there's no general right for law-abiding citizens to import their foreign wives or husbands into the UK unless they're self-sufficient. And yet we believe that foreigners who don't have a right to be here at all, or might in actual fact have done something criminal, have a right to a family life and can avoid deportation because they can cite the European Convention. This is nonsense on stilts. Now, to briefly return to the business about achieving ostensibly good goals with bad processes, if you can show that you used the positive obligations of public bodies to successfully pursue cases against the Yorkshire Police or the Ministry of Defence, you don't thereby show that it's a good principle that public bodies should have the kind of positive obligations that allowed you to pursue those cases in that way, compared to all the other ways that public bodies could have been regulated so as to not, for example, allow recruits to be killed in army bases or for the cops to engage in inept policing. So it's a fallacy if you stop and think about it. The fact that human rights lawyers have been successful in holding hopeless public bodies to account doesn't mean that a state which is looking to have public bodies that aren't hopeless should choose to actually give those public bodies nebulous positive obligations and then rely on human rights lawyers to regulate the conduct of those public bodies. The fact that the Ministry of Defence is hopeless in controlling the military and that bad behaviour of a terrible kind for too long existed in army camps, worth pointing out that deep cut was a problem right into the 1990s, long after the Human Rights Convention supposedly informed the conduct of all our affairs. So it's a non sequitur. It doesn't follow that because bad organisations have been held to account using bad procedures, we should proceed with bad organisations and bad procedures in order that they continue to be held to account by this kind of method. The argument that the MOD is a disaster when it comes to regulating the conduct of the Army in particular, less so the Navy and Air Force perhaps, but if the MOD is a disaster, and that not enough warrant officers and officers and senior NCOs have been jailed and stripped of their pension and kicked out of the forces, if the MOD lacks the mettle to actually do what it did, for example, to a general recently and jail him for basically ripping off the state, ripping off the people by putting his kids in an independent school when the mother lived nearby and then lying that they were all living far away and the kids had to get their expensive boarding education on the public purse. If they're not prepared to jail him, another 50 like him, for example, if they're not prepared to actually force people in the command, in the hierarchy, to control the people beneath them within military law. I mean, the idea that we need nebulous statements followed by human rights cases following multiple deaths to control the military, when we've got regulations, Queen's regulations right now, which make hugely unlawful all of the actions which went unpunished for so long in deep cut and should have resulted in massive numbers of people being in the glass house and large numbers of supervisory staff being busted down into lower ranks or being kicked out of the military. You don't justify bad process by saying, here's a good outcome from bad process, so let's not worry about good process, but let's just proceed on the basis that this is never going to get fixed. There's another argument of this, another aspect of Spurrier's argument that should be noted. Like all lawyers, she demands that the state act with specificity. When, for example, you know, a search warrant is going to be executed, and you can't justify a search warrant on the basis that the constable has got a hunch that probably good things will come from kicking in doors. If the cops can demonstrate that that some good things come from breaking laws, then the lawyers don't say, well, in that case, I won't actually worry about compensation or making a complaint or taking a case. So they demand that the state act with specificity in all its actions, apart from judges. So if you think about the structure of the argument in favour of the present way of going on when it comes to the Human Rights Act and the relationship between the state and the judges, what the human rights activist lawyers are actually saying is that when it comes to, for example, assessing asylum claims, the state has to behave with absolute rigour. So you can't say, for example, that a large number of people in this cohort are potential lawbreakers and terrorists, therefore we're going to reject all the claims because we can't afford to have any of them in the country. No, you have to assess each of the claims and you have to behave lawfully and be specific in the exercise of your functions. But when it comes to the courts assessing the actions of government, then a nebulous statement of rights coupled with an infinity of cases produced by other countries, which, because you're making a human rights argument, can be cited. Normally in a British court, you would cite the decisions of higher courts. So, and they would be, you know, persuasive based on the hierarchy of the courts and the strength of the judgment. So if you're looking for a good judgment, you'd be looking for, you know, the Supreme Court, the old House of Lords judgments, the Court of Appeal, the High Court. You know, you'd be looking for a good solid judgment. English judgments are persuasive in Scottish courts, but they're less persuasive than maybe a good court of session judgment. An inner house of the court of session, a judgment on a reclaiming motion where the judges are actually considering an appeal in a nice tight point that's exactly like the one that you're trying to make. That's the argument you would rely on. And that's how the system operates. Now, the business of saying that specificity is necessary across the board, except when it comes to human rights cases pursued in the courts, in which case a broad statement of rights and then an appeal to the court to consider whatever case you think might suit you, regardless of whether it comes from a foreign jurisdiction, because all those foreign jurisdictions sign up to the Human Rights Act as well, the convention as well, and therefore these cases can be persuasive. This is a whole new radical way of going on, which, if you stop and think about it, it lacks what the rule of law requires because it lacks predictability. You know, it's not just the individual that's entitled to predictability. It's the wider society and the state functionaries as well. The parliament needs to have predictability when it makes its laws. And the way things are happening at the moment is that the Human Rights Act and the cases that then follow once you make an appeal to that, because you can appeal to Portuguese, Spanish, whatever cases, the whole thing is becoming entirely unpredictable. And law that isn't predictable isn't law, because the law has to be a mechanism. It has to be the case that can be known. And at the moment, it can't be known. And it led to, right at the early stage, when this legislation was first passed, when the Human Rights Act first came in, they had to set up a special body, I think, under the Blair government. From memory, late 90s, early 2000s, but they set up a special body where public agencies could phone up, the police and so on, and the immigration service could phone up and ask these, I think, lawyers whether they thought something that they were about contemplating could be done. Because it got to the stage where the cops wouldn't actually release photo fit pictures of suspected offenders, because these senior officers were saying, well, isn't that an infringement of the rights of everybody who somewhat resembles this the suspected offender? So the whole thing becomes unknowable, you know, the Gina Miller case, where three of the judges out of the 11, The Gina Miller case was a case where it wasn't obvious what the Communities Act 1972, it wasn't obvious what it meant for individuals' rights. Was the intention of Parliament to grant to individuals certain rights? And I agreed with the three dissenting judges that this argument was tendentious, that it was designed to produce a particular outcome without any real regard to the strength of the argument, because it was thought that the appeal was being made, the argument was being presented to people who were minded to accept it and were falling over themselves to find a fig leaf. However bad the argument in the Miller case was, it is as nothing compared to the arguments that are pursued when it comes to, for example, trying to prevent the deportation of folk who've bought a field and then filled it with caravans and are now claiming a right to a family life because their kids are playing with other kids in the local village and are enrolled in the school. So this whole way of going on is inconsistent with knowable law, because courts are entitled to refer to some kind of Code Napoleon almost, aren't producing knowable judgments. No landlord could know what they're getting into when they sign a lease with a tenant, given what we are prepared to accept as legal judgment when it comes to a right to a family life. I mean, if you're a landlord and you're signing a lease with a person who seems pretty reasonable, and then they move somebody into the property who seems wildly unreasonable, and your lease is silent on whether you're entitled to vet the person, then once they make an appeal to their right to a family life, the fact that they're terrifying all your other tenants and causing the police to constantly be at your door might not be the decisive argument that it would have been otherwise, because you've put yourself in a position where the judgments of French and German courts and the vagaries of particular lowly courts are going to have to be anticipated and can be anticipated. You're putting yourself in a position where it's not just, for example, what happened in the United States, where the COVID crisis resulted in landlords being forced to accept tenants who weren't paying rent for a year and now won't be able to recover that rent, and essentially they've been paying the mortgage for a year without receiving any rent. You're not just putting yourself in that position, you're putting yourself in a much more general position, which is that even in the absence of crisis, you can't really know what will happen when you head to court. As to the supposed right to protest, we've actually put ourselves in a position where we've conceived of protest as being the right of every individual to do what Bentham thought the state does when it punishes folk, which is to make crime an ill bargain. We've actually allowed protesters to make democracy an ill bargain. So what we've actually done is we've said, if you can't actually persuade the public to make massive sacrifices, if you've got one MP, Caroline Lucas, I think, from Brighton Pavilion, from memory, if you can't actually persuade the public to take the view that you take of what measures are appropriate, then you're entitled to coerce them, and this is protest. So blocking motorways and supergluing your face to the roads and smashing glass, ironically high quality pilkington glass that will require huge amounts of CO2 to replace it, but all of these things are in actual fact protests. Well, they're not protests, are they? They're actually attempts to raise the stakes such that people will actually give you what you want because it's less trouble than tolerating what you're doing. That's not a protest. And it's indicative of how we've bent the language out of shape that we call it a protest. And as for, you know, being concerned about folk who might be employed by GCHQ or the Security Service or Special Forces or whatever, denying them whistleblower protection, if they leak information, they're going to be still liable to the Official Secrets Act. We've already had cases like long ago Ponting and Tisdall, where the juries are very reluctant to convict if they think there was a genuine public interest. And a state can't function without secrets, and a state can't function, therefore, without functionaries who don't violate secrecy. And you could argue that there should be a Privy Council process whereby somebody who complains internally has got a right to contact a Privy Councillor in a letter and tell them what they feel has happened. But the idea that you've actually got some right to, you know, leak information about how GCHQ functions or how the security service operates. No state could tolerate that, because the idea that an individual is entitled to decide whether the organisation is in actual fact acting unlawfully, that again places an individual in a position where their sort of judge and jury, if you like, involves exactly the same right being granted to the dissenting individual, the grandstanding individual, that you grant to the person who glues their face to the road. The old Hobbesian injunction was that those who do this kind of thing should expect a reward in heaven and not complain. If it really is the case that you feel you have to walk into the Channel 4 news studio and tell everyone that GCHQ is taking every single piece of information that comes into the UK in fibre optic cable, and the parliamentary committee that oversees the functioning of SIS and GCHQ are prepared to accept this, but you're not. If you really are convinced that you have to walk into Channel 4 news studio and reveal that, then I don't think you can reasonably ask that you be protected additionally by whistleblower legislation or whistleblower principles. Whistleblower principles derive from Human Rights Act principles. I don't think you can reasonably expect that when you're already protected by jury trial and process anyway. If a jury takes the view that you're not actually trying to sabotage the very functioning of the British state, but instead are trying to preserve it, then you'll be acquitted. And I hardly see that you're entitled to something over and above the protection that jury trial presents. A bigger issue would be if they started trying you with judges and no juries. You know, the old line about juries are the light that shows that freedom lives. I think Lord Denning said that. A trial for serious offences conducted without a jury would be problematic. So I think there has to be a process whereby well-placed whistleblowers have got the possibility of going outside the chain of command and writing to a member of the relevant parliamentary committee or a privy councillor. But there can be the case that whistleblowing is trumps, as it were. And so long as you're engaged in a sincere act of whistleblowing, then you can engage in it, regardless of whether mature consideration causes any reasonable person to think that this is the sort of thing that will bring down the system itself, that such a right held by everybody is inconsistent with having a security service and having a diplomatic service and having spies and having a GCHQ that functions to preserve security and to interdict bombers and so on. If I choose to blow a whistle, and the very fact of my sincerity is proof that I shouldn't be prosecuted, then we won't be able to have a state at all. That kind of right is inconsistent. It's like giving the soldier the right to construe an invasion of a country, or for example the Argentine conflict. If British soldiers have a right to say that they won't obey unlawful orders, and now if that's construed as being the right to say that we should have proceeded with the UN peace proposals and the American peace proposals before we use military force to retake the Falklands, if that's the construction that you choose to place on the right of a soldier to refuse to obey unlawful orders, because the soldier can reach a view as to the plausibility of UN intervention and whether the American peace proposals might actually work out. So the soldier says, I don't think Margaret Thatcher and the government pursued the UN's proposals sufficiently far, and therefore this obligation to attack Mount Tumbledown is an unlawful order. If you place that construction on what individuals are entitled to do, you don't have a state. Now, just finally, the concerns that people have about voter ID, I think it's worth remembering what the great John Stuart Mill said about postal voting and paying for people to be taken to the polls and so on. Mill was hugely hostile to anything that facilitated that kind of ease in voting, because he said essentially if you require to vote distantly or to be conveyed to the polls, then probably you don't take your vote very seriously, and you shouldn't be exercising it because it's a public trust. And that is an argument that strikes folk as being very odd, because it's an argument that's predicated on a view of what we are, and what the state is. It's very much, if you read Mill's Considerations of Representative Government, then the whole thing is very much Athenian. It's very much as if everybody was Louis the 14th, as I always say, l'état c'est moi, I am the state. So the citizen thinks of themselves as having a particular relationship to the state. And the great Hobbes says of the Spartan assembly that every Spartan is fully a member of the assembly, and when they walk out of the assembly, then they're fully subject to the decisions they've made. And therefore, the Spartan assembly, despite the fact that it's in that sense absolutely democratic, is entirely consistent with his view of what sovereign power is. And this piece in The Guardian about rights is part of a broader move, and we've seen it for the last 2 years during the COVID crisis. It's part of a broader move of, in my view, speaking as somebody on the centre-right, it's part of a broader move to institutionalise and normalise this infantile view of what government is. Government is us. As I've said probably before, my moment of epiphany was in a forest aged, I think, 20 in Germany in 1984. I couldn't have been 20. I must have been 19. I was in a forest in Germany with my machine gun full of blank ammunition. And we'd been roaming about Germany, practicing supposedly to resist a Soviet invasion. And of course, this is worth mentioning because obviously on the border of Ukraine, there's a massive Soviet, a Russian build-up rather. And I remember having this moment of epiphany, l'état c'est moi, I am the state. You know, the British state is nothing unless people actually do things. The state's sinews and blood vessels are our citizens. And the state has no money, no power. I was ranting on Twitter this morning about the £18,000 that we're continuing to borrow every month, as if 10 million people were given £1,800 in borrowed money. And people praise Rishi Sunak and are really happy. And there was a discussion this morning on Radio 4 about universal basic income as part of the Christmas lectures. And people seem to have this childish idea that the state is something other than rules and principles, procedures and laws, and that these organise us and direct our efforts. But that is what the state is. And we have to decide really whether we're citizens of a liberal democratic state with a perfect right to go about our business unless prohibited, and a positive obligation to be good citizens and take full part and full interest in our affairs, or whether we want to be truculent and petty and explosive and indignant and childish and volatile and unpredictable, and therefore take no responsibility whatsoever for the kind of government that we create. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I went through to the Perth hustings and watched Jeremy Hunt and Boris Johnson in operation. And despite the fact that I was convinced that Hunt wouldn't try to get us out of the European Union, he would try to frustrate the Brexit process, I still voted for Hunt because I couldn't bring myself to vote for Johnson because of his behaviour, because of what Steve Norris said regarding his unwillingness to actually take seriously any role, including in that case London Mayor, and as my view, as we found out, being Prime Minister. So we need to work out whether we're actually prepared to take a good look at ourselves, or whether we're prepared to continue with Band-Aid, because that's what given perhaps well-intentioned judges the right to decide cases based on nebulous principles amounts to. This is Band-Aid. This is an attempt to shore up your body using short-term solutions that necessarily entail longer-term costs. If you think that we can have a society where the people take no interest whatsoever in their collective affairs, and then individuals use the courts to try and secure something for themselves or particular cohorts, if you think that's a stable, prosperous, liberal democratic state, with the kind of citizens that Mill envisaged at its heart, then I think you're kidding yourself. I think it's something quite different. It's a state where essentially state functionaries are either malignant and lazy and empowered, or well-intentioned and benign and empowered, but at no stage are they actually democratically accountable or our servants. And we need to understand that when we put ourselves under authority, as Aristotle said, citizens, when they reach old age, are excused the duties of citizenship, which includes ruling over others, because all legitimate rule is exercised on behalf of the people it's exercised over. To govern is to serve. And if we can actually sort of reinvigorate some of these sort of perhaps civic republican ideas, we're going to end up in one hell of a state. And arguably already we are in one hell of a state. Anyway, peace.